Hello everyone, welcome to the Quantum Gravity Seminar. And just a quick announcement before, after that, for the people who are at Perimeter, we're gonna go for lunch in the bistro, so welcome to join. And for the meantime, we'll have an exciting talk by Arjun Kaur from University of British Columbia that's gonna tell us more about non-isometric quantum error correction in gravity. The floor is yours.
Okay, thank you very much for the invitation. I'm happy to be here virtually. I hope to come in person sometime soon. Today I want to tell you about some recent work that appeared last month. This is the archive number, and it's about a particular quantum error correcting structure in gravity. So here's just some background information. I want to keep the talk kind of slow-paced. If we don't get to some of the technical details, that's okay. Please, you know, stop me and ask questions. So the holographic approach to quantum gravity implies that there are two descriptions of gravitational physics. And the first is the semi-classical description, which involves a curved space-time with dynamical gravity and propagating quantum fields. And this description is only approximate. There's a second description, which is sometimes called the microscopic description, and it consists of a lower dimensional quantum theory without gravity. And this description is exact and constitutes, in some situations, a non-perturbative definition of quantum gravity. The existence of two descriptions of the same physics, one of which is missing some microscopic details, is a familiar situation. And we have tools like, for example, the renormalization group to make such ideas precise in quantum field theory, for example. And what's unfamiliar in gravity is the existence of black holes. So black holes in the semi-classical description lead to apparent inconsistencies, which do not arise in standard situations without gravity. And two related examples of such inconsistencies that you probably have heard about are what's called the black hole information paradox and also the more recent firewall paradox. Now, ideas from quantum information theory have been helpful in sharpening the apparent disconnect between the semi-classical and the microscopic descriptions. So in particular, quantum error correction serves as a link between the two descriptions. The basic idea of that story is that there is a linear map V, sometimes called the dictionary, which embeds a subspace that I'll call H lowercase b of the semi-classical Hilbert space into H big B, the microscopic Hilbert space. So I'll denote that map like this. Now, the error correction properties of the map V come from the fact that the semi-classical subspace HB is encoded redundantly in H big B, the microscopic space. So what that means is that erasing part of the microscopic space leaves behind a remainder, which can still be enough in some favorable situations to reconstruct some part of the semi-classical space. And to ensure the consistency and functionality of this encoding structure, it's necessary to impose, usually, some restrictions on this semi-classical space as a subspace of the full infinite-dimensional Hilbert space. And a common choice of subspace is a small energy band of local semi-classical excitations around a particular background geometry. So you should think of this subspace as, you know, a finite number of local operators applied to some smooth gravitational background. And this usually ensures, well, such a choice usually ensures that there are enough states. Laurent has a question. I can't.
A clarification. So, because yes, the expert is here that people have. So, would you call HB? Can I think of it, you know, as the boundary, whether it's at infinity or in ADS? I really don't care. And then the big B is the bulk, right? That was your sense.
The other way around.
The bulk, the big is the bulk, or the small?
The lowercase b is the bulk, and capital B is the boundary. Yeah.
Okay. So capital C is, yeah. Okay. Could you just maybe explain a little bit why the boundary, which is smaller, has more information than the bulk? Because you this is what you see.
Yeah, so you can think of this as, so for the, this will be...
I'm thinking in terms of gravity, but you think that the bulk has a big redundancy because we have the Hamiltonian constraint. So, you know, that's where the redundancy...
Good.
The boundary, the boundary, okay, might have the same, but it's encoded in a more efficient.
That's right. So the redundancy here, in at least in anti-de-Sitter space, where we know that the CFT exists in some sense on the boundary, you can think of this redundancy as, you know, I've phrased things in terms of Hilbert spaces here, but you can also think of it as a spatial redundancy. So it has to do with the bulk radial locality in some sense. So an operator that lives, you know, in the center of the bulk, if you erase a little bit less than half the boundary in empty ADS, for instance, you'll still be able to reconstruct the operator that lives in the center. So everything that I'm saying here about erasures and redundancy, you should think of in the ADS CFT example in terms of the error correction properties of bulk radial locality. It doesn't have to do so much with the actual, you know, number of states themselves, although in the interior, we will see that it has to do with the number of states themselves, that there's a problem with the number of states. But the usual error correcting structure in holography has to do with the emergence of bulk radial locality. Yes. It's not so much related to the gravitational constraint.
Yeah, so that's maybe because of the community we're in here, where people really focus on the role of the gravitational constraints, where somehow we would say that, well, there's no such operator as being locally radial, right? Because the gravitational constraints means that
good. It
has to be completely delocalized in the boundary. So is there one aspect of your story that somehow take that into account?
So in the model that I'm going to describe, so for the experts, this will be what's called the West Coast model of black hole evaporation. This is a system in which canonical quantization of the gravitational Hilbert space on a fixed Cauchy slice is actually possible exactly. So the dilaton gravity theory that we'll be working with, you can solve all the constraints and directly quantize the system canonically. So this, you know, we don't really have a hope of doing in higher dimensions, but in the story that I'm going to describe, this little HB is really completely well-defined. And even in that situation, we'll see that, you know, this non-isometric structure that I want to get to is relevant and important.
So the little HP, can I think of it, is it the bulk before I impose the constraints, or it's the bulk after I impose the constraints?
After. Yeah. You should think of it as, you know, you could canonically quantize gravity, it is a subspace of that Hilbert space. Yes. And in this model that we'll be working with today, you actually can do such a thing.
Thank you.
Good. Okay. Other questions? Okay. Good. So to ensure the consistency and functionality of this encoding structure, it's necessary to impose some restrictions on H little b as a subspace of the full bulk Hilbert space. And a common choice of subspace is a small energy band of local semi-classical excitations around a particular background. And what I was saying before is that this usually ensures that there are enough states in the microscopic description to encode all of the relevant semi-classical subspace in a useful manner. But in some situations with black holes, and these will be the most important situations for the discussion today, choosing a small energy band will not even ensure the most basic requirement of standard error correction. That is to say that the semi-classical space, the Hilbert space, subspace of the semi-classical description, should be smaller than the Hilbert space of the microscopic description. So this is a problem which we will address. Let me just point out one time when that happens. In the information paradox, one explicitly encounters situations where semi-classical physics in the black hole interior is expected to be valid for a very large number of states. So this little b can be much greater than the size of big B compared to the black hole entropy. But in general, it's not possible to faithfully encode a large Hilbert space into a smaller one. So the goal of this talk is to explain in a toy model of black hole evaporation, how gravity gets around this issue and manages to encode semi-classical states from a larger space into a smaller microscopic space. And the semi-classical states, again, are effective field theory excitations in the interior, and the microscopic states are the black hole microstates. Okay, so that was the motivation. Here's the outline. So we'll start with a review of some relevant facts from isometric error correction. Then we'll talk about a proposed model that's fairly recent for non-isometric error correction. And then these second two points are slightly more technical. We'll define a code explicitly of the West Coast model of black hole evaporation using Euclidean path integrals. And then we'll study some properties of the non-isometric interior code. I want to say that it's totally okay if we don't get to some of the more technical aspects of section 2 and 3. There are good places where we can jump to kind of get to a good point where the talk will still be understandable, I hope. So please ask me questions if you have any.
Arjun, hi.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I don't know whether you can see me though, but...
I think anyway. I can, yes.
Okay, good, excellent. I'm on my iPad, sorry. So I have a question about the introduction. So I just don't understand one thing. I don't want to waste too much of your time. We can discuss later if you want, but... In which sense do you state that the lower dimensional theory is microscopical about the bulk quantum gravity theory? I was thinking, if I think in terms of ADS-CFT, for instance, I was thinking of that as an exact duality in the large Toft limit. So for me, there are two ways of describing the same system. So in which sense the boundary system knows more about the quantum gravity in the bulk than the bulk system itself?
Yeah, good. So the bulk system here, we're thinking of as some effective field theory around a fixed background. So this sort of description of gravitational physics is not exact. In order to do exact bulk physics, you'd have to understand something like string theory on this, either on this background or string field theory more generally. Yeah. So if you can define non-perturbatively a string theory directly in the bulk, then you have two descriptions, which should be exactly dual, just like in the n equals 4 case. But in general, I don't want to think about any string theory in the bulk. I just want to consider the limits of semi-classical effective field theory in the bulk. So that description is only approximate. So the sense in which the boundary knows more is that the boundary includes, you know, for example, the string field theory degrees of freedom.
I have a fast question, since you used notions such as larger and smaller Hilbert space. Do you assume an infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces or
all Hilbert spaces in this talk will be finite dimensional?
Are finite dimensional? Okay.
Yes.
So is everything is discrete in the end?
That's right.
Thanks.
Okay, very good. So let's begin with the review. So standard quantum error correction begins with an isometry L between a code Hilbert space that I'll call H code and a physical Hilbert space H fizz. And I'm going to distinguish these from the map V and the two Hilbert spaces that I defined before, which we will only use in the gravity context. So L is a map between these two spaces and it satisfies the isometry condition. So L dagger L is equal to 1, the identity on the code subspace. And the isometry condition implies that the code space needs to be less than or equal to the physical Hilbert space dimension, essentially by counting. If the code space was larger than the physical space, then you can show pretty easily that there must exist a non-zero state, let's call it alpha, in the code space, which is annihilated by the map L. And that makes the isometry condition impossible to satisfy. Now, the sense in which L corrects errors is that L allows what's called simulation of unitary operators W on the code space on the encoded state in HFIS. So that's captured by this equation. All it means is that if I act with the unitary operator W on some state in the code space and then act with the dictionary, I can achieve the same effect by first acting, or approximately the same effect, by first acting with the dictionary L, the encoding map L, and then acting with some reconstructed operator W tilde. And I should be able to do this for any state in the code space up to some small error that we'll call epsilon. And this condition, if I don't impose any restrictions on the form of W tilde, is trivially satisfied by what's called the global reconstruction. And that has the following formula, where W tilde is just LW L dagger. Now, if you plug this LWL dagger directly into this formula and use the isometry property of L, you'll see that you get zero on the right-hand side. So that's fairly trivial, but the non-trivial error correction properties of the encoding map L are related to the case where this W tilde can be defined using only a subspace of the physical Hilbert space. If we're able to satisfy this simulation condition, even when W tilde acts only on a subspace of the physical Hilbert space, we can erase the irrelevant parts of the physical space on which W tilde does not act and still simulate the operation of W by this formula. So that's what it means for an error to be correctable. Now, when L is far from an isometry, it's not clear what to expect from a theory of error correction, because even the global reconstruction, which trivially worked previously, is guaranteed to fail on certain states. So trying the global reconstruction from before in the error correction criterion yields an error proportional to this formula. So you can see that if L satisfied the isometry condition, this formula would be zero. But as we saw before, when the code space is larger than the physical space, there must be a state which is annihilated by the encoding map L. And considering that state in the above criterion will give a large error. Assuming the state is normalized, it gives an error equal to one. So a proposal for a non-isometric error correction has been developed recently. Preliminary steps were taken in this paper, and then much more detail was given in this paper from this summer. Now, let me just summarize the main ingredients. The main ingredients are a discrete set that I'll call S of states in H code, and a notion of approximate state-specific reconstruction, which should be possible for states in S and operators W, which preserve S. So the new condition has this tilde W operator again, but this time it can depend on the state that you put in. And this is only required to hold for states psi and W psi, which are in this specific discrete subset of the code subspace. So one asks only for error correction on this discrete set S in the code space and for operators which preserve it. So in this way, non-isometric codes do not faithfully encode the entire space H code, but only a discrete subset thereof. And the question of what this subset should be or how large it can be taken to be is a fundamental question that we will have to deal with.
Well, can I ask a question?
Yes.
When you say non-isometric error correction, do you always assume a causal subspace is larger than physical space?
For the purposes of this talk, yes. It turns out that if the code subspace is smaller than the physical Hilbert space, and you construct, for example, the non-isometric code that we will discuss in this talk, it looks and behaves very much like an isometric code. So when in some sense, the regime when the code space is larger than the physical space is the critical regime. There's a transition between the two regimes. So the behavior of the code is quite different when the code subspace is actually smaller than the physical Hilbert space, even if the map itself is not an isometry.
I see. And so basically, you're considering a late time regime of black hole evaporation.
That's right. For the gravity people in the audience, that transition is the page transition.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, very good. So before discussing that in more detail, let me just give you a use. Yes, Benny?
I just wanna ask, so it does this need to be a discrete set, or should I just think of it all the Hilbert space bound by these discrete sets of states?
Good. So at least in the proposal that was made in this paper from the summer, it does seem that the set needs to be discrete.
So I don't consider only like zero state, one state, but I shouldn't think about like zero plus one state.
Exactly. It's difficult to think of this this set S in terms of a subspace. It will just be some discrete set. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Right. Because if you could really take superpositions, then you would end up spanning the whole semi-classical Hilbert space, and that would get you into trouble.
All right.
Yeah. So that's going to be the mechanism by which gravity ends up encoding a larger Hilbert space into a smaller one by kind of discretizing the bigger space. Yeah. Okay, good. So a useful method to verify the state-specific error correction criterion is the decoupling principle. So that's the formula that I've written here. And it essentially compares the norm of two different states. And if the norm of LW acting on psi is comparable to the norm of L acting on psi, then this implies the existence of a tilde W unitary operator, which reproduces or reconstructs the action of W on the state psi. And this is a fairly intuitive criterion, because if the two states L psi and LW psi have approximately the same norm, then they're approximately related by a unitary rotation in the physical Hilbert space, W tilde. And the state dependence is present because when L is not an isometry, we cannot guarantee that the same rotation will work for any choice of psi in this discrete set S. Okay, so this gives a natural type of set S for any non-isometric code L. And what we're going to consider is a set of states in H code which have approximately preserved overlaps or norms after the action of L. So we'll say that a set S that we'll consider is going to be such a set that any two states within this discrete set have their norm or their overlaps approximately preserved under the action of this encoding map. So the difference between the overlap before and after is bounded by some small error parameter. So what that means, just in words, is that the discrete sets S that we'll consider are those upon which L acts almost like an isometry. So it almost preserves the norms and overlaps. Now, the most basic question about non-isometric codes L, then, is to understand the properties of such sets S, including their typical size and the allowed subspace reconstructions in the physical Hilbert space. Okay, so any questions about generalities of non-isometric codes before we move on to black holes? Okay.
Maybe just a
yes.
Remark compared to my original question. So this, at least it seems to fit more what people would do in quantum gravity. So in quantum gravity, you would imagine the bulk, you know, as a kinematical Hilbert space, which is much, much, much bigger than the physical Hilbert space after you impose the emitter constraints. So you know, the bulk, which is H code in your things, has to be bigger than whatever the boundary, which is, for me, it's not really about the boundary, it's really just about the space of solution of the emitter constraints, right? So
that's right, but
that seems to me a much better framework for quantum gravity than the original ADS-CFT ones, because that's what you would expect quantum gravity to be.
Right. So here again, we're going to work in a model where the constraints in the bulk are exactly solvable and canonical quantization actually works perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
So the canonical quantization of the Hilbert space and the bulk is what we will be calling the semi-classical theory. And that theory already has more states than the boundary theory.
So what you call semi-classical theory is H code.
It already takes into account these effects.
Well, I'm saying this is generic, like a theory of quantum gravity has to be like that.
And that's right.
And not of the first type that you described, which is so it seems ADS. Yeah. So, okay. So we're good. So I'm not sure what was the motivation then for people in ADS-CFT, because they believe the opposite picture. What was the motivation for quantum
I'm not sure I quite understand what the opposite picture is. So here,
that H code is smaller than H physics.
In
quantum gravity, that cannot be the case.
Good. This code subspace is, remember, a subspace of the bulk Hilbert space.
Yeah.
And if you take a little energy band, for example, of states around empty ADS, for example, it actually will be the case that there are enough states in the boundary to encode the, you know, these low energy excitations in the bulk. It's really around black hole backgrounds that you encounter the problem that I'm discussing.
What about or just non-perturbative quantum gravity, like quantum gravity simply, right?
I'm not sure that I've totally understood the question. We can discuss.
Yeah, we can discuss.
I have a question. Can you comment, or maybe just on this discrete subset and giving up superposition? So, is it in the end that you want to just reconstruct semi-classical states.
That's right.
Which you do not superpose, and so the
exactly. Yeah. So the goal will be to try to push the code space, the number of states for which we expect semi-classical physics to be valid, as far as possible. So we want to include as many states in this set S as we can. We will unfortunately have to give up things like superposition in order to do this.
Yeah, how dangerous is it in the end?
That's a good question. So there was an argument made in this paper by Chris Akers and friends from the summer that it's not so dangerous as long as the complement of this set S satisfies a certain criterion. And mm-hmm. the criterion should be that there's a kind of complexity separation. That was their proposal. In the sense that it's difficult to verify if you're a bulk observer that you're actually living in one of these states that has a norm that is not preserved under the dictionary. It's difficult in a computational complexity sense. I don't want to talk about complexity at all in this talk. Yeah, I'm gonna talk only about, for example, the main idea that I want to convey is roughly the size of this discrete set S that can be achieved in gravity. Yeah, that's one of the main calculations that I want to explain the result of. But we won't talk about complexity at all, but these are good and important questions. Yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, can I ask a kind of follow-up question? So it seems to me that this state in S, I mean, is it psi 1? If psi 1 and psi 2 are orthogonal, then a similar equation should be true for superposition states as well, right? Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
Oh, good. So it's not necessarily true that if you have two states that are orthogonal, mm-hmm. that their superposition, all possible superpositions can also be orthogonal, right? So you need to consider all possible superpositions of this guy, mm-hmm. Of these two states, which would correspond to something like psi 1 plus a phase on psi 2. Mm-hmm. And this phase can take any value on the unit circle, and that will cause a problem.
Yeah. Okay. I see.
Yeah. Good. Okay. Very good. So let's discuss the model. I may skip over a couple technical things here, but we'll see how much time we have. So a useful toy model for black hole evaporation is ADS2 JT gravity with non-dynamical end of the world brains. And that model kind of rose to fame in this paper. It was defined very carefully and was given a non-perturbative completion. So here's the Euclidean action of the theory. There is a topological suppression term, the Euler characteristic with some ground state entropy. There is the usual JT term. It's a dilaton gravity theory. So this phi field is the dilaton. There's the R plus 2, which fixes the metric to be negative curvature, ADS. And there's the boundary term with some holographic renormalization. Then there's a brain term. And the boundary conditions on the two types of boundaries, the asymptotic boundary DM is this one. And the brain boundary has the so-called dual boundary conditions where the extrinsic curvature is set to zero and the gradient along the normal direction of the dilaton is equal to the tension. So this mu parameter is the tension of the brain. And we'll construct a non-isometric dictionary V sending semi-classical to microscopic states by using the Euclidean path integral of this theory and its holographic dual. So let me just briefly... Yes.
Sorry to interrupt you right here because I have a very ignorant question. Apologies for it. Mm-hmm. Can you just tell me in one word, one sentence, why that's a useful model? Why ADS2 and not Minkowski 2? Why the end of the world brain and not something else? Why that boundary condition?
Good.
Real quick, sorry, just to
good,
for me good. To understand.
The one sentence version of why this model is a good model. Well, there are two fundamental reasons that this model is a good model. The first is that it really has a completely well-defined non-perturbative completion that is under control and can be proven from Euclidean path integral techniques. That's reason number one. Reason number two is these end of the world brains allow you to very simply get models of a strong entanglement between the black hole interior and some auxiliary radiation space. So they allow you to consider states which in some sense push up against the information paradox. So those are the, you know, lightning reasons why this model is useful and good.
Just could you explain what's the relationship between the brain and the black hole?
Yeah, so that will come soon. Yeah, I'll draw the geometries. Yeah. But first, let me review the Euclidean path integral. So the simplest Euclidean path integral prepares the thermal partition function. And in the microscopic theory, the Euclidean manifold is a circle with circumference beta. The line segment represents the Euclidean evolution operator, this e to the minus beta h, h is the Hamiltonian, and joining the two endpoints of this line segment into a circle generates the trace. Now in the semi-classical theory, we have a similar construction, but the Euclidean manifold is two-dimensional, and it's a disk with the hyperbolic metric, and that fills in this circle with renormalized circumference beta. So here's the picture. So this picture on the left generates what's called the semi-classical thermofield double state. And this picture on the right, cutting along the dashed blue line, generates the microscopic state. So as usual, to create states, we cut open these Euclidean path integrals along Cauchy slices. And as I was saying, this leads to the semi-classical state, this lowercase TFD, and microscopic state, capital TFD. So here are the expressions for the experts. The thing that you should note here is that in the semi-classical description, the approximate description, we have effectively a continuous density of states, this rho E. For people familiar with the whole Schwarzian story, this is the Sinch density. And in the microscopic description, we have a Hilbert space, which is discrete. So these are individual energy eigenstates. For the experts, these are eigenstates of the matrix model Hamiltonian, dual to JT gravity. Good, so the main point that I want to convey in this section is that the dictionary V acts by hollowing out the interior of the semi-classical path integral, and it leaves behind the microscopic path integral. So we will write formulas of this sort where V acting on a semi-classical state gives you a microscopic state. And the way that that translates in path integral language is you take the bulk semi-classical path integral and you kind of hollow out the interior and leave behind the boundary conditions. And then the same Cauchy slice is related by an action of the dictionary V. That's the main point that I want to convey here. The equations are not so important to understand.
Maybe could you show back again the definition of the big TTFD? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. The one, okay. So the what you call the bulk is this density. Okay.
That's right. In the bulk state, you have this smooth density of states, this Sinch density. And in the boundary, you really have a discrete set of energy eigenstates. So in some sense, the semi-classical picture has coarse-grained over the microscopic description.
Sorry, the fact that you have a discrete set is something you impose by hand, or how do you choose?
This? No, this is an outcome. Yeah, so this is this comes out of the analysis. Yeah.
And what is the choice of this En? What property do they satisfy?
They're eigenstates of the boundary Hamiltonian.
But the boundary Hamiltonian, isn't that okay? That's your state H. What was the relationship between what your H is, which is the modular Hamiltonian, and your boundary Hamiltonian?
Because this H is the physical Hamiltonian. It's the one that generates energy. It's not the modular Hamiltonian. Yeah.
Okay.
So the one which has e to the minus beta H is the thermal state.
And the one which has density rho E is the modular Hamiltonian.
This rho E is a density of states. So it's just a function of the energy. And we integrate it against this Boltzmann factor along with this ADM energy eigenstate to get the semi-classical thermofield double state.
And this energy is the energy of which one, the modular or the boundary energy?
The boundary. This E is the ADM energy.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're going to describe it. So what's the idea that somehow you're saying your erasing procedure just subselect
the erasing procedure does the following. So it takes the picture on the left and turns it into the picture on the right. And all you do is you remove the interior. You keep the same Cauchy slice, but you remove the interior of the path integral.
And
that why gives you a,
okay, but I have the same Hamiltonian. I'm trying to understand which Hamiltonian.
No, good. So the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian, which gives you eigenstates of this bulk ADM energy, is this Morse potential Hamiltonian that you may be familiar with from the canonical story of JT. Mm-hmm. The Hamiltonian on the boundary that gives you these EN eigenstates is the matrix model Hamiltonian. So this is a microscopic Hamiltonian, which in some senses is a non-perturbative completion of Euclidean JT gravity.
And is there another semi-classical? Yeah. Do I have a semi-classical correspondence between these two Hamiltonians? Or
yes.
Okay.
Can you remind me what is a Renormalized circumference?
Good. So in the boundary conditions for JT gravity, we had this boundary metric ds, which was equal to this d tau, the proper length divided by some epsilon. So if I integrate this boundary metric, I'm going to get something proportional to 1 over epsilon. And epsilon is vanishing, so that length is diverging. But there's a strength of that divergence, which is called the renormalized length, and that's beta.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Good. Okay, so now here, very briefly, let me just discuss how you insert excitations in the interior. So to create an excitation in the interior, what we do is we insert one of these boundary brains. And in the Euclidean picture, the pictures I've drawn here, on the left, you have this Euclidean brain going through the bulk, and we actually take the Cauchy slice to intersect that brain. So now this is a single-sided black hole instead of a two-sided black hole. And in the boundary, we have these two red dots, which are the boundary brain conditions. So brains go through the bulk starting and ending from these red dots. Now the corresponding states are the semi-classical and microscopic brain states. So these formulas are a little bit intimidating, but just know that this is the main formula. This action of V on the semi-classical brain state, the lowercase br, gives you the microscopic brain state, again, by hollowing out the interior of this path integral. The one important thing that you should take away from this slide is that, you know, before we had kind of a very nice correspondence between the thermofield semi-classical state and the thermofield microscopic state, now we have a little bit of an extra ingredient. So you'll see in the microscopic brain state, there are these coefficients Cn. So these coefficients will be crucial for the story. I'll describe them more on the next slide. But otherwise, everything here is the same, up to some function, which is not very important. Good. So the coefficients that appear in the microscopic brain states are actually complex Gaussian random variables with zero mean and unit variance. That's not a trivial fact, but proving it would take a bit too long, so let me just take my word for it. By adding B flavors of brains, we can create different types of interior excitations. So these are like adding different flavors of particles in the interior, which do not interact. And so we'll define
the definition of Cn. Okay, well, that's
yes. Okay. Yeah. So Cn is appearing only here in the microscopic brain state.
So it depends on the shape of the brain, or it's...
It does not depend on the shape of the brain. Yeah, the Cn are just complex Gaussian random variables with zero mean and unit variance. They depend on no details of the geometry. Good, so we will explicitly define...
Your boundary theory is, if I understand properly, now your boundary theory is not a unitary theory.
Now the boundary theory is an ensemble. Okay, very good. So now it's a statistical ensemble.
We're kind of leaving quantum gravity. We're having something else.
Indeed. Yeah, there's something, some more general structure on the boundary that we will study. Good.
And the motivation for getting out of the unitary realm of quantum gravity is... Can you say a word about it?
So the motivation is, the motivation is that this still qualifies as a good non-perturbative completion. So the fact that the boundary is some non-unitary ensemble, you can still think about what's called quenched expressions, where you, in each individual member of the boundary ensemble, which is a unitary quantum theory, you compute some expression that gives you a unitary answer. And then you average over the ensemble and you get some averaged unitary answer. So this has to do with all these recent discussions of rectifying the page curve, for example.
Okay, so is that supposed to be some kind of approximation then of quantum gravity,
where we of the full string theory, for example? Yes, I would say we don't quite know how this sort of theory comes out of, for example, string theory or some other higher dimensional quantum gravity. There have been some efforts to understand that.
And then when I have an average, there's some kind of scale I have to use to average, right? Or distribution. So is that?
Yes, there is a.
That's some physical.
There is a distribution. It's this distribution that I'm describing here. These complex Gaussian random variables, they have zero mean and unit variance. So there's no scale because the variance is one. Yes. So there's no scale, and it's independent of the Newton constant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Alex, did you have a?
Yeah. Just a basic question. Did the CNs depend on the flavor of brain?
Good. I'm about to. So that's the next sentence.
Okay.
So when you add the flavors of these brains and define H lowercase b as the span of these states. So in the semi-classical description, the flavors are non-interacting and the states are all orthogonal. But in the microscopic theory, adding flavors extends this set Cn of complex Gaussian random coefficients to a set Cn xi, where xi labels brain flavor.
Can you explain what you mean by a brain flavor? What is the
difference? Yeah, so a brain flavor just means that there's some label that comes along with the brain. And if I have two, for example, if I have two boundary conditions that have different flavors, then there cannot be a bulk brain that goes between them. So that's the rule.
And is there a geometrical interpretation of the flavor?
There's no geometrical interpretation. The dynamics and the geometry is all the same. It's just an extra label that you add. So it modifies the path integral in a certain way. But there's no physical significance to the flavor. It's like having different particle flavors that have all the same quantum numbers, except the flavor. So the point of the flavors is just to get more states into the interior, to mock up a large number of semi-classical excitations in the black hole interior. Yes.
Oh yes, I have a question. Could you go back one slide?
Mm-hmm.
Going to the next slide. Said you add a flavor, and can I think of it as some kind of boundary primary?
Yes, there's a sense in which it's like a topological version of inserting a primary operator. Yeah. But it does not change the energy of the state. So different flavors all have the same energy in the bulk. So it's different in that sense.
I see. Do you have any explicit representation of these flavors in terms of boundary safeties?
So here in this two-dimensional model, the boundary theory is a matrix model. So it's some ensemble of quantum theories. And the explicit representation of the flavor is just by this extension of these Cn coefficients. So you extend the Cn into this Cn xi, and xi labels the brain flavor. And that's the only effect on the boundary.
I see. And is there any top-down models giving such kind of setup?
There have been attempts to construct this sort of model from top-down considerations. I don't know if anyone has landed exactly on this model. But it's an open question, and one that a couple people have been exploring. Okay, very good. So I'm a little bit short on time. Let me just summarize this the interior code. So we're also going to pass to the microcanonical ensemble. That means we fix the coarse-grained energy instead of the inverse temperature. And that eliminates a lot of these extraneous tension and energy-dependent factors in the state coefficients. Furthermore, it makes this boundary to this microscopic Hilbert space finite. So that was a little bit fast, but let me just say that if you take away one slide from this part of the talk, this should be it. The upshot of all of this is that the dictionary that we have in this toy model is actually an ensemble of dictionaries. So it's some random variable. And the ensemble that you draw from is this complex normal distribution, many, many copies of the complex normal distribution. So this dictionary is a complex Gaussian random matrix with independently and identically distributed entries. Now, the fact that an ensemble appears, as we've discussed, is related to recent discussions of ensemble averaging in low dimensional gravity. So now we need one more ingredient to make the black hole evaporate, and that is to add a radiation reservoir. So I'll call that HR, and we add it in both the semi-classical and the microscopic descriptions. And that allows us to consider entangled states, as we were discussing before, between the interior excitations, the brain flavors, and the radiation. Now we extend the dictionary by the identity on this radiation reservoir. So this is the upshot of the whole black hole interior code. We have some ensemble of codes L, where this C is a complex Gaussian random matrix drawn from this distribution. And we have this identity on the radiation factor. So what we want to do now is study the properties of this ensemble as non-isometric error correcting codes. Good. So I think I have time just to state the main theorem. So let me try to get to that. So we're going to use the ensemble to study the averaged error correction properties. So specifically, our goals are to study the typical size of the discrete state sets S, which have preserved overlaps. That's probably the main result that we'll get to. And I'll briefly mention the allowed subsystem reconstructions on the microscopic space or the radiation space using the decoupling principle. And just to make that more clear, the latter question is more explicitly the following. When a unitary operator acts only as, for example, WB or WR, so it acts only on these factors of the Hilbert space, when can we reconstruct it using tilde WB or tilde WR, where these are acting only on the denoted subspaces? Now, the subsystem results, this is a comment for the experts, they must be consistent with entanglement wedge reconstruction. So let me just briefly say how we do this. I won't give any details of this, but the ensemble that we have found is a high dimensional Gaussian distribution on a complex Euclidean manifold. And to study its average properties as a family of non-isometric codes, we use measure concentration. So those techniques were pioneered by these authors. Roughly speaking, measure concentration is a property of certain probability distributions on Riemannian manifolds, which allows one to use low moments of sufficiently well-behaved functions to put strong bounds on the probability of deviations from the mean. So the sorts of theorems that we'll use look like this. So let GC be what's called a kappa Lipschitz function, and then one can prove a theorem like this that we will make use of. So what this theorem says is that the probability in the ensemble that we defined of this function G being greater than or equal to its mean value plus some small deviation epsilon is upper bounded by something which is exponentially suppressed in 1 over kappa squared. Now, the notion of a kappa Lipschitz function formalizes what we called well-behaved on the previous slide. A kappa Lipschitz function is just one that has changes bounded by the geodesic distance of the underlying Riemannian manifold. So this defines a kappa Lipschitz function. So what this says is that if kappa is very small, then the change in G between two points in the underlying manifold is very small compared to the geodesic Riemannian distance, which is just the Euclidean distance in this case. So that allows us to prove a result for this function F. So we let F measure the norm of the state after applying the encoding map L. So here's this function F. It's a function on this ensemble that we defined before. Psi is any state in the code subspace. Computing the Lipschitz constant for F and applying measure concentration and the union bound, we find a bound on pairwise overlap representation in the state set S. And probably the rest of the talk will be explaining what this formula says. So what we have here is a probability of some, we have some set of states S, and we're considering the maximum pairwise overlap change. So we have this expression from before, which measures the overlap change after the action of L between any two states, psi 1 and psi 2 in this set S. And the probability that the maximum such change is greater than some small amount, so this b to the minus gamma is some small number, it's suppressed in, for example, e to the minus gamma s, where s is the black hole entropy, this probability is sharply bounded by this quantity. So the important features of this quantity are that there's some polynomial in the number of states. So there's a quadratic polynomial in the number of states that multiplies an exponentially suppressed quantity. So this exponential quantity, if the black hole is large, is very, very small, because this B, again, is the microscopic Hilbert space of the black hole. So this is e to the s. So this suppression on the right-hand side is e to the minus e to the s, where s is the black hole entropy.
So is B related to the size of s, or what's your notation?
No, so this size of B is the black hole Hilbert space dimension. This okay. size of s is this discrete set that we've been defining.
And so where does the big B enter in the definition of L, or?
Big B enters in the definition of the code. So the code sends this little b to the big B.
Okay.
Yeah. And this big B is the space of black hole microstates. So there are e to the s of them, where s is the entropy. Good. So the meaning of this bound, let me just explain it and then I'll finish. Is the following. So as long as the number of states in S is parametrically smaller than this quantity, exponential in this size of B, so the 1 minus 2 gamma, the right-hand side of this expression, so this object, is small when B is much greater than 1. So we have an inequality that looks like this. But the important thing is that for any choice of S which obeys this bound, when B gets large enough, the right-hand side will be small. And when the right-hand side of this expression is small, there is a very high probability that a randomly chosen encoding L from our ensemble will approximately preserve all pairwise overlaps in this discrete set S to within some error. So here, what we're doing is estimating the size of this set, and we allow some error which scales like e to the minus S, where again, S is the black hole entropy. So this is quite a small error. And we found that actually quite a lot of states can be supported by this method for the typical code. So what this means, as I was saying, is that the typical black hole interior code allows for the encoding of a discrete set of states, which is in fact quite large. And it's sub-exponentially large in the black hole Hilbert space dimension. We can compare this to the total number of states in the microscopic space itself. And in order to do that, we'll discretize that space. So in the Haar metric, a projective Hilbert space has a finite volume. And discretizing this volume with epsilon balls, the Hilbert space with dimension capital B has roughly this many states. So you can see that it scales exponentially with capital B. But the power of capital B up in the exponent is 1. And we were seeing that the S can be as large as e to the B, where alpha is a little bit less than 1. So what, yes. There are two questions.
So maybe I can start. So maybe I missed it, but the main inequality that you're using depends on your function being kappa Lipschitz, right?
That's right.
But you're using f of c, which is the dictionary or defined in terms of this v. Function?
So f is the function which we're computing the Lipschitz constant for. I didn't tell you how it's computed, but that's the function that we're computing the Lipschitz constant for.
So you don't know, like we don't know that it's kappa Lipschitz.
Oh no, we do. Yeah. So I haven't written explicitly what the Lipschitz constant is, but you can see the paper for the proof.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yes, another question.
Yeah, I have a question about the inequality, which is it specific to the example you constructed, or is it more general?
This particular theorem?
Yeah.
Yes, this is specific to the dilaton gravity model that I was describing. Okay. Yes.
Okay. And what are then the crucial properties? Is it the Gaussian measure or the?
Yes. The most important property is the Gaussian measure. Yes, exactly.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good. So as I was saying, what this means is that the interior code manages to make fairly efficient use of the microscopic Hilbert space. So this scaling exponential of b to the alpha, where alpha is small number, is some small number, is not actually so much slower than exponential of b with a 1 up in the exponent. This log of 1 over epsilon you should think of as some large constant, but it doesn't contribute to the scaling with the Hilbert space dimension. So the interior code, at least in this dilaton gravity model, makes fairly efficient use of the microscopic Hilbert space while preserving the semi-classical overlaps parametrically well. So as b gets larger and larger, this error quantity gets smaller and smaller because gamma is some small positive quantity. Good. Let me skip the subsystem reconstruction business. You can ask me about that later. So here's the technical summary. After reviewing expectations for isometric and non-isometric codes, what we did is construct a non-isometric code in dilaton gravity. We studied its properties. Using measure concentration for the Gaussian distribution, we found that global operator reconstruction can be supported for discrete state sets S, which can be as large as sub-exponential in the black hole Hilbert space dimension. And furthermore, so I didn't talk about this, but you can ask me later, we used the decoupling principle to show that subsystem reconstructions are possible in regimes consistent with the entanglement wedge predictions. Good. So let me just conclude by pointing out a couple interesting things. There are some interesting aspects of the interior code. Maybe most mysteriously, the semi-classical Hilbert space of interior excitations is re-quantized or discretized in the fundamental description. And certain states in the semi-classical description have no fundamental meaning. And the number of states that can be described semi-classically is still very large, but the structure of truly typical interior states remains unclear. And they may involve firewalls. Let me skip this point about averaging. It's kind of a technical one. So this non-isometric error correction structure represents the current limit of semi-classical physics in the black hole interior. It would be very interesting to prove that the dilaton gravity code that I discussed today is asymptotically optimal, at least when applying measure concentration techniques. If true, it would mean that there's a parametric difference between the total number of states, not just in a basis, but in the discretized sense that I was describing before, in a microcanonical window, and states which have reasonable semi-classical descriptions, where by that I mean operator expectation values should match up to non-perturbative corrections. Now, whether the non-isometric structure can be extended to capture more of the microscopic Hilbert space is unclear. In a more practical direction, maybe let me say that the improvement in the state size S of the gravitational code over Haar random tensor network methods, which were employed in this paper from the summer, is actually parametrically large by a polynomial power of 12. So compared to previous models of this sort, the model that I described today is, let's see how to describe it. If this model from the summer, thought of as some algorithm runs in time, x to the 12, then the model that I described today runs in linear time. So it's that order of improvement. Now the theory of non-isometric codes deserves further study from a quantum information standpoint. And the fact that this improvement by a large polynomial power was possible may mean that they have the potential to be useful tools in what's called the NISQ era of small quantum devices. So let me stop there. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Sorry, I was muted. Thank you very much for your talk. Let me ask first if students have questions.
Yes. There is one people have questions.
Yeah. Yes. Go for it.
Sorry, maybe just a basic clarification question first of all. So when you say that, I'm just a little bit still not quite fully grasping, I guess, the definition of this V map that you defined. So you say that it's like hollowing out the bulk. Can I think of it as like you're integrating over the bulk fields?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the appearance of this C, right? When you insert a brain and then you do the same thing, the appearance of this C can be, so in a sense, C can be written as a integral over some things, I guess. Is that true?
You should think of C as degrees of freedom in the boundary. So these are degrees of freedom in the boundary that one integrates over in order to reproduce the bulk dynamics. Yeah, so the fundamental thing which happens is that when you have this boundary theory and you consider a path integral in the boundary that looks like this, a boundary segment, you need to integrate over these complex Gaussian variables in order to connect up these brains. So the brains start from one of these red points and end at one of these red points. And integrating over these Cs is responsible for generating those connections in the bulk.
I see. Okay, so you're saying that by doing that, I'm essentially reconstructing the brain.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, I see. I see. Okay. And it makes sense that you only have one tensor factor of En here.
That's right, exactly, because here this Cauchy slice only cuts one point on the boundary.
Yeah. Exactly, okay, that makes sense. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's good, thank you.
Yep.
Bianca, go ahead.
Thanks for this nice talk. You mentioned something which was like some states in the semi-classical sector do not have any interpretation. I guess
that's right.
Meaning they cannot be mapped to the boundary.
That's right.
And so in general, so you restrict basically the dictionary. I mean, first it's to a subset of the bulk Hilbert space, but also to a sub Hilbert space, but exactly. Also to a subspace. So, I guess a long time ago, there was kind of this idea, quantum gravity time evolution is kind of unitary because you have a unitary time evolution on the boundary. But mm-hmm. if you have kind of a boundary bulk map, which is quite restricted now, does that still hold?
Yeah, so quantum mechanics on the boundary is perfectly fine. So there, in the microscopic description, you only quantum mechanics. There's linearity, unitarity, all the good properties. So in this system that I described today, it turns out that the boundary theory is an ensemble, as Laurent was mentioning. So that's an extra subtlety. But just generally speaking, quantum mechanics is fine on the boundary. In the bulk, it's a different question, and this is related to what was asked before. But there was this. There was this conjecture in this paper from Chris Akers and friends over the summer that the thing which protects you in the bulk from verifying these sorts of violations is complexity.
Mm-hmm.
That's still at the status of conjecture, though. It is consistent in the following sense. So it's consistent with the results that I described today and also the results from that paper from Akers and friends in the summer, in the sense that complexity, the set of reasonably preparable states, in terms like low complexity states in the bulk, is much smaller, or is of a comparable, at least at most a comparable size, to this size of S that we estimated here. Mm-hmm. So this inequality here, the right hand side is large enough to capture all states which have low enough complexity, where mm-hmm. where low enough in this context means actually also sub-exponential. So there is at least a consistent way to save quantum mechanics for some bulk observer that has bounded computational power.
So it's that unitarity is kind of holds in some sense for low complexity states.
Exactly.
But not necessarily for more complexity states.
Exactly. If you could really do an arbitrarily complex operation in the bulk, then all bets are off. But in that case, we have some suspicions that the bulk description will start to break down anyway. So it will be hard to think about a semi-classical observer moving in some space-time if they have the power to perform exponentially complex measurements.
But maybe, I understood that this business was started because of the information paradox, which comes
That's
from
right.
being unitarity, and now it's kind of given up.
So the information paradox, in some sense, is resolved by boundary unitarity. So boundary uh-huh. unitarity has never been a question. It's a separate question to claim that a bulk observer can or cannot get into trouble with unitarity in terms of the measurements that they can perform. That's a separate question with respect to whether the full evolution is actually unitary or not.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Subayan.
I just wanted to ask a question about the quantum information aspect of the non-isometric code. So if you disallow superpositions of the states in the code space, I wonder if it like also affects like the linearity of the quantum eradication code as a whole and affects the quantum eradication conditions. And I'm also suspecting whether is this actually a classical eradication code hiding as a quantum eradication code?
That's an interesting question. So I don't know exactly what type of structure this is, but let me just say that the error correction conditions are modified indeed. So that's this state-dependent error correction that I was writing before. So previously in the isometric version, let me just remind you that this W tilde does not depend on the state. Once you choose W, it's fixed for all states in the code subspace. In this non-isometric business, W tilde can have explicit dependence on the state and actually must in order to have an interesting reconstruction theory. As to your second question of whether this is secretly a classical error correcting code, I'm not sure. It may, well, let me not say too much. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
It's an interesting question.
Takato, if you have a question, go for it.
Yes. In your final expression, I only see the size of B rather than the size of radiation, and I wonder why there is no contribution from the size of radiation.
Right. So there's no contribution from the size of the radiation, essentially because we chose the dictionary to be the identity on the radiation factor. If we had chosen something non-trivial for the radiation dictionary, then there might be some radiation factors appearing here.
I see. Yeah.
So that's kind of a technical explanation of why.
Is it reasonable to assume this dictionary is completely factorized between the radiation degrees of freedom and black hole?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. At least from the semi-classical perspective, it seems reasonable that that the corrections in quantum gravity, because when we think about the difference between the semi-classical and microscopic descriptions, we really have in mind the gravity picture. So there's some gravity theory that we call this H little b, and there's some microscopic theory which we map the bulk into. Now, the radiation is kind of this auxiliary object that goes along for the ride in this toy model. In a real theory of quantum gravity, these two systems have to be combined, right? Because the radiation lives in the same space as the semi-classical space-time. So that's a more sophisticated situation. I don't know of any microscopic models where you would really have control over that system. It may be that you need to use, I don't know if you've been following some of these algebraic quantum field theory developments that, for example, Pennington and Witten have been talking about, as well as Hong Liu and Sam Leutheusser. But it may be that a framework like that is necessary to understand some of these things. In fact, there was a paper last week from Tom Faulkner about these issues.
Well, I think my confusion comes from the island business. So when you consider the island region, then the radiation, the regime of radiation also lives on inside the black hole interior, right? So in such a case,
Okay. So good. In these island discussions, in the most well-defined models, the radiation always lives in a location where gravity has been turned off. So there's, for example, in this model, there's no dynamical gravity in HR. HR is just, for example, some system of qubits or a spin system. In the East Coast model of evaporation, for another example, gravity is turned off in this flat space bath that they couple the ADS system into. So in all these island models, the radiation system is always non-gravitating. There is some progress on computing, you know, things like microscopic entropies when the radiation system does gravitate. For example, I had a paper with Vijay Balasubramanian and Tomonori Ugajin on an issue like that. There was another paper from the Stanford group about that. But in most of these island stories, the radiation is non-gravitating. Yeah, that's a limitation which should be overcome, but
I see.
Okay. Hasn't quite yet, yeah, I would say.
And also, let me confirm. Since the size of radiation is not included in, is absent in the final expression. So this kind of suppression of error, the success probability for the quantum error correction here is very high right after the page time.
Yes. Well, it depends on the size of this set S. In real models, if you try to discretize the interior Hilbert space, right after the page time, you have the dimension of this little b is comparable to the dimension of big B. So in that sense, right after the page time, the error correction is quite strong. As you go further and further past the page time, it gets more difficult. To ensure that all of the semi-classical states remain orthogonal under the dictionary, and that's in some ways it makes sense because after the page time, as you probably know, that the interior is kind of growing, right? So there's this nice slice of the volume which grows, so you have more and more degrees of freedom, naive semi-classical degrees of freedom in the interior after the page time.
I see. Thank you.
Thanks. So, okay, let's take the last two questions. So one by Laurent and after by Benny. So go for it, Laurent.
Hi, Arjun. Thanks for this very nice talk. I have a more mm-hmm. broader, maybe philosophical question about diffeomorphism invariance. So if I step back and I think about what qualifies in general for theory of quantum gravity, it has to be an object that somehow, you know, respect diffeo invariance with the presence of a fundamental length scale. Could you explain to what extent this model fits in that category?
Good. Yeah. So this
gravity definition.
Yeah. This model is. Let me flip back to the Lagrangian. So this model is a bit different than, you know, for example, a string theory that has some string length and so on. So it has a couple parameters which are kind of analogous to those. So this. Sure. This S naught is the ground state entropy, which is kind of analogous to 1 over G. So this is the strength of the Newton coupling in this model. There isn't really a fundamental length scale in this model after you set the ADS length to 1. So this 2 is really a 2 over LADS. And if you set LADS to 1, then there's not really a fundamental length scale.
Well, if you have a discrete model, you do have, at some point you have discrete spectra of area and things like, maybe fundamentally, you know, you have this fundamental discreteness, but
that's
the
right.
So it's more about diffeo invariance, how that fundamental discreteness kind of respected or implemented in that model, diffeomorphism like this fundamental.
Right. So this action is a fairly standard one. It is diffeomorphism invariant, for example.
Yeah, I'm talking about the model you add at the end, which is, you know, this matrix model, the brains, the flavor, the code.
Oh, okay.
Like the, you know, because we departed a long way from this action.
Yeah. Yeah. So the so statement is that, yeah, that model at the end with the flavors and the random matrix and all of those things is a non-perturbative completion of this model that was proven in this paper. that the Euclidean partition function of this model is reproduced by that that random matrix theory. So the sense, and when I say non-perturbative, what I mean is that there's a perturbative expansion of this model in the genus suppression. So you have the sum over topologies that we usually have in Euclidean gravity, and each one of those geometries is suppressed by the Euler character. Now that forms a perturbative expansion, which actually in this system does not converge. It's only an asymptotic series. So there is a non-perturbative completion of that asymptotic series, which comes from this matrix model with the complex Gaussian random coefficients.
I guess I was looking for something. Forget that model here. It's more about, okay. You had the slide at the end. It's more in the end. You gave me a model with lots of features, radiation states, Hood subspace, kappa, etc. Where, I mean, forget that, you know, let's say I cannot follow where it comes from this model. So in what sense the endpoint where you compute has something to do with this, representing diffeomorphism invariance in the bulk? Like, is there a notion which people understand that? I thought you had a point which mentioned diffeo invariance in your conclusion that you.
Oh, didn't. Good. Yeah. So,
in what sense can I be, you know, should I believe that this has to do with
right? You can ask the question, if I take an individual member of the ensemble of boundary Hamiltonians and brain states and so on, is this individual theory dual to something which is diffeomorphism invariant in the bulk? So that is a question that you can ask. Is there a bulk description of an individual theory which is diffeomorphism invariant? And this paper by Blomert and Usatyuk roughly says that the answer is yes. So by roughly, let me explain a bit more what I mean. So in this paper, what they do is they try to start with the ensemble that I described, this JT plus brains and so on, and they try to kill the ensemble in the sense of they try to add dynamics, which are diffeomorphism invariant in the bulk. So they try to add things to the action in order to land on a single boundary theory, a fully unitary quantum mechanical theory. And they're successful, but the price that they pay is they have to add a lot of interior dynamics. So the brains are no longer non-interacting in the bulk, but now they have pretty strong interactions that need to be incorporated somehow. So that's the price they pay. Their model still looks diffeomorphism invariant in the sense that, you know, the things that they add to the action all look like they have the correct symmetry. They have a minimal string construction basically of this sort of model. So in that sense, we do expect that, you know, a typical draw from this ensemble will have something like diffeomorphism invariance in the bulk. It's just that you'll need to understand the interior interactions in much greater detail.
Okay, but you do not have a representations of the diffeomorphism action. So usually,
no, yeah, that's
you expect that you cannot tell me what is the spectra of diffeomorphism or.
Yeah, exactly. You on the boundary, what you really have is just a quantum mechanical theory that has some couplings, and those couplings control the dynamics of the brain. And so, if you put all those couplings in, you can kind of remove the ensemble that you started with. Yeah, but it's hard to see how that will arise from, for example, like a fully diff invariant object. Although it's a good question. Unfortunately, I don't have a very sharp answer. I think the answer which comes closest is discussed in this paper. That's what I would say. Yeah. Yeah, Benny.
Sure. So in my understanding, so states in S are physical and their superpositions are physical, but what about operators? So basically, operators mapping around these states on S are physical, and for others, it's kind of physical.
Good. So yeah, I would say that as you said, states in S are the ones that have good semi-classical descriptions, and operators that preserve this set S also have good unambiguous semi-classical descriptions. if you get the problem, if you try to escape from this set S, is that you might end up in a state which has a norm that is highly modified by the dictionary. And it might even have a norm which is zero. And if it gets sent to a state in the microscopic description which has zero norm, then there's no semi-classical meaning.
Right. So
this state.
I just want to make sure that, so complexity, if I talk about complexity of these operators, these complexities are low in boundary quantum mechanics?
This is a different notion of complexity than the boundary. This is a notion of bulk complexity.
So on the bulk, such operators are simple.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's simple mean like local or?
Simple meaning local, yeah.
But then I can just easily do e to the I theta dot operator to make a superposition, right?
Let's see.
So I mean, my understanding or my impression was that this complexity thing were on the boundary, and these physical operators are easy on the boundary. But then on the bulk, this could be still like a...
Yeah, the complexity of the operators in the bulk is a sensitive question in the sense that there are some operations which are simple in the bulk and other operations which are quite difficult. So I would say that the difficult operations are when, for example, so I didn't talk about these subsystem reconstructions very much, but there's a phase, as you know very well, when you're after the page time and you can reconstruct interior operators on the radiation.
Mm-hmm.
So in this phase, reconstructing interior operators, we expect to be hard. We expect it to be quite difficult. But that is a statement that depends on the state, right? Because you see in the condition for entanglement wet reconstruction, when interior operators can be reconstructed on the radiation depends on the von Neumann entropy of the radiation, of course, right? If the von Neumann entropy of the radiation exceeds the black hole entropy, then you expect reconstruction on the radiation. And that's a situation in which I would say the complexity is large, but that's a state-dependent statement, right? If I'm in a state where I haven't crossed over the page transition yet, there's not enough entanglement, then the bulk operator is only reconstructible on the microscopic space, H capital B. So I would say that operation is not so difficult.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. Thanks again, Arjun, for a nice talk and the question session. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And let's close the talk there.